This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The 17th Suspect, written by James Patterson and Maxine Petro, read by January Lavoie. To the friends of the Women's Murder Club. Part 1. Chapter 1. Just after 4 a.m. under a starless sky, a man in a well-worn tweed coat and black knit cap crossed Broadway onto Front Street, humming a tune as he strolled south to Sidney G. Walton Square. The square was a cozy one-block park, bounded by iron fencing with an artifact of a brick gate set at a diagonal on one corner. Inside were paths and seating and garden beds, cut back now at the end of the growing season. During the day, Walton Square was crowded with office workers from San Francisco's financial district, eating their takeout lunches near the fountain. At night, the streets were empty, and the park was occupied by homeless people going through the trash cans, sleeping on the benches, congregating near the gate. The man in the shapeless tweed coat stopped outside the iron fencing and looked around the park and surroundings with purpose. He was still humming tunelessly and gripping a 9mm gun in his right-hand pocket. The man, Michael, was looking for someone in particular. He watched for a while as the vagrants moseyed around the park and on the sidewalks that bounded it. He didn't see the woman he was looking for, but he wasn't going to let this night go to waste. As he watched, a man in a ragged layering of dirty clothing left the park and headed east, in the direction of the Embarcadero and the piers, where the garbage in the trash cans was more exotic than discarded office worker sandwiches. The ragged man was talking to himself, scratching his beard, and seemed to be counting, touching his right thumb to each of the fingers on his right hand and pensively repeating the ritual. He didn't notice the man in the tweed coat standing against the fence. Michael called out to him,
"Hey, buddy, got a smoke?"
The ragged man turned his bleary eyes to the man pointing the gun at him. He got it fast. He put up his hands and started to explain.
"No, man. I didn't take the money. It was her. I was an innocent."
The man in the coat pulled the trigger once, shooting the bum square in the chest. Pigeons flew up from the adjacent buildings. The bum clapped his hand over his chest and opened his mouth in a wordless expression of shock. But he was still standing, still staring at him. Michael fired another shot. The ragged man's knees folded, and he dropped without a sound. He said to the corpse,
"Worthless piece of shit. You asked for that. You should thank me."
He looked around and ducked into a section of shade in the park. He placed his gun on the ground, stripped off his gloves, jammed them into his pockets, and shucked the old coat. He was dressed all in black under the coat, in jeans, a turtleneck, and a quilted jacket. He transferred the gun to his jacket, gathered up the coat, and stuffed it into a trash can. Someone would find them. Someone would put them on. And good luck to him. Michael slipped out from behind the copse of trees and took a seat on a bench. Screams started up, and the crummy vermin poured out of the park like a line of ants and surrounded the body. No one noticed him. There were no keening sirens, no, "Dude, did you see what happened?" Nothing. After a few minutes, the killer stood up and, with his hands in his jacket pockets, left the park and headed home. There would be other nights. One of these times, he was bound to get lucky. Chapter 2. On Monday morning, Assistant District Attorney Yuki Castellano was in the San Francisco DA's conference room, sitting across the mahogany table from a boyishly handsome young man. Yuki was building a sexual abuse case that she thought, if brought to trial, could change the face of rape prosecution on a national scale. An executive at a top creative San Francisco ad agency had allegedly raped an employee at gunpoint, and Yuki was determined to try the case. After she quit her job and spent a year at the nonprofit Defense League, District Attorney Leonard Red Dog Parisi had asked her to come back and try an explosive case as his second chair. But they had suffered a humiliating loss. Now, Yuki wanted very much to have a win for herself, for Parisi, and for the city. She asked,
Mark, can we get you anything? Sparkling water? Coffee?
No thanks. I'm good.
Mark Christopher was a television commercial producer with the ad shop and the victim in the case, claiming that Brianna Hill, the head of the agency's TV production department and his boss, had assaulted him. The sex crimes detail of SFPD's Southern Station had investigated Christopher's complaint and found convincing enough evidence to bring the case to the DA's office. After reviewing the evidence and meeting with Christopher, Yuki had asked Parisi to let her take the case to the grand jury. Parisi said,
Yuki, this could be a glue trap. You're going to have to convince a jury that this kid could keep it up with a loaded weapon pointed at his head. That a woman could rape him. You really want to do this? Win or lose, this case is going to stick to you.
She said, Len, I'm absolutely sure he was raped, and I can prove it. If we get an indictment, I want to run with this.
Okay,
Len said dubiously.
Give it your best shot.
In Yuki's opinion, non-consensual sex was rape, irrespective of gender. Women raping men rarely got traction unless the woman was a school teacher or in another position of authority, and the victim was a child or, more commonly, a teenage boy. In those instances, the crime had more to do with the age of the victim than a presumed act of brutality by a woman. In this case, Brianna Hill and Mark Christopher were about the same age, both in their late 20s. Christopher was Hill's subordinate at the ad shop, true, but he wasn't accusing her of sexual harassment at work. He claimed that Hill had threatened to shoot him if he didn't comply with a sadistic sex act. Would Hill really have pulled the trigger? For legal purposes, it didn't matter. It mattered only that Mark Christopher had believed she would shoot him. As Len Parisi had said, it was going to be a challenge to convince a jury that this confident young man couldn't have fought Hill off, that he'd maintained an erection at gunpoint against his will, and that he'd been forced to have sex with a woman he had dated and had sex with many times before. But Yuki would tell Christopher's story. He'd said no, and Hill had violated him anyway. Yuki had seen the proof. The grand jury would have to decide if there was enough evidence to support that version of events. Once this case went to trial, win or lose, Mark would be known for accusing a woman of raping him. If Brianna Hill was found guilty, she would go to jail, and the face of workplace sexual harassment would change. Chapter 3. Glass walls separated the conference room from the hallway, with its flow of busy, noisy, and nosy foot traffic. Yuki ignored those who were sneaking looks at the broad-shouldered, dark-haired agency producer slumping slightly in his chair. He was clearly wounded, describing what he claimed had transpired 2 months before, and seemed very vulnerable. Yuki stepped outside the conference room to have a word with a colleague. When she returned to her seat, Christopher had turned his chair so that he was staring out through the windows at the uninspiring third-floor view of Bryant Street.
Yuki said, Mark, let's talk it through again, okay?
He swiveled the chair back around and said,
I understand that I have to testify to the grand jury. I can do that. I'm worried about going to trial and how I'm going to react when Brianna's attorney calls me a liar.
Yuki was glad Mark had dropped in to talk about this. He was right to be apprehensive. Brianna Hill's attorney, James Giftos, looked and dressed like a mild-mannered shoe salesman. But that was just a disarming guise for an attack attorney who would do whatever it took to destroy Mark Christopher's credibility. Yuki asked,
How do you think you might react?
I don't know. I could get angry and go after the guy. I could break down and come across as a complete wimp.
It's good to think about this in advance, Yuki said. But Giftos won't be at the grand jury hearing. We're just asking the jury for an indictment based on the facts of this case. I think the jury is going to believe you, as I do. If Hill is indicted, Yuki continued, we go to court. She'll be there to contest your testimony and present her version of this attack. James Giftos will do everything he can to make you look like a liar and worse.
Oh, God. Can you walk me through that?
Okay. I'll give it to you straight. Because you dated Brianna, you won't be protected by the rape shield law. Giftos could ask you about your sex life with Brianna in detail. How often, what it was like, what made you invite her to your apartment. Nothing will be off limits.
Wonderful, said Christopher miserably. Piece of cake.
The press will cover the trial. Public opinion may favor Brianna and you may be verbally attacked. It could get very ugly, Mark. And when we win, your life may never be quite the same.
The young man covered his face with his hands.
Mark, if you don't want to go through with this, I'll understand.
Thanks for that. I'll be ready. I'll make myself be ready.
You have my number. Call me anytime.
Yuki walked Christopher to the elevator, and as she shook his hand, he said,
I thought of something.
Tell me.
You should talk to Paul Yates. He's a copywriter at the ad shop. We're only casual friends, but I think something happened with him and Brianna.
Really? Something sexual?
I don't know, said Christopher. I'm pretty sure they dated. They seemed friendly around the shop, then the big chill.
There's no record of him speaking to sex crimes.
No, I don't think he talked to them or anyone. I would have heard.
Paul Yates, Yuki said. I'll get in touch with him. Mark, stay strong.
His smile was shaky when he got into the elevator car. Yuki stood in place as the doors closed, then headed back to her office. She wasn't confident that Mark would hang tough, and she couldn't blame him. In his place, she would feel conflict and fear too. But the key facts in the case against Brianna Hill were incontrovertible. Mark had recorded the rape, and Brianna always carried a gun. Mark's testimony would bring those facts to life for the jurors. Chapter 4. 2 days after her last meeting with Mark Christopher, Yuki got a call from James Giftos, Brianna Hill's defense attorney.
Miss Castellano, James Giftos here. My client wants to speak with you. By chance, do you have a gap in your schedule sometime this week?
Oh? What's this about?
Yuki's laptop was open, and she began making notes as Giftos spoke. He said,
Ms. Castellano, Yuki, my client wants to tell you her side of the story. She hopes that when you hear what really happened, you'll see that Mr. Christopher's allegations have no basis in fact. She's willing to apologize if there's been a misunderstanding, and then, she hopes, Mark can drop the drama and they can go on with their lives.
So James Giftos wanted a queen for a day interview, a proffer agreement. In this meeting, Ms. Hill would attempt to convince Yuki that she should drop the case because of insufficient evidence. The rules of engagement for these interviews were clear. Brianna Hill and her attorney would come to Yuki's office where Hill would be sworn in, then submit to Yuki's questions, her answers transcribed by a court reporter. Hill would not be allowed to invoke the Fifth Amendment, and most importantly for Yuki's purposes, if the DA decided to proceed with the case, nothing Hill said could be used against her in the grand jury hearing or at trial. However, and it was a big however, if Hill took the stand and her testimony differed from what she'd told Yuki under oath, all bets would be off. Her formerly privileged testimony would no longer be privileged, and Yuki could use anything she'd said in her proffer interview against her. It was a good deal for the prosecution. Brianna Hill would give her side of the story, meaning that Yuki would learn the basis for the opposition's case. Yuki said to Giftos,
"Turns out I have an opening at 2 today."
"Sold," he said.
Yuki hung up with Giftos, made notes to add to the file, and then walked down the hallway for a pickup meeting with Len. Chapter 5. Yuki greeted Brianna Hill and James Giftos at 2 that afternoon and walked them to the conference room where the court reporter was waiting. Hill was petite, her dark hair blunt cut to her shoulders, and she wore a modest silk blouse and sharp gray suit. She was very pretty, and Yuki knew that she was also plenty smart. Born and raised in Dallas, Brianna Hill had a film degree from USC and an MBA from NYU. She had gotten her first job at a production company, and a few years later was hired by the ad shop, where she rose quickly to head of TV production. As head of TV, Hill reported to the agency president and was responsible for millions per year in TV commercials for big-name clients. Brianna looked the part of a highly placed young executive. She appeared cool and confident, but Yuki noted the dark circles under her eyes and the way Hill clutched at the silver crucifix hanging from a long chain around her neck. Giftos turned off his phone. Hill was sworn in, and the court reporter typed at her console in the corner of the room. Yuki said,
"Ms. Hill, do you understand that this interview means that we have a binding agreement? That you are required to answer all of my questions truthfully, and, if you don't tell the truth, our agreement is void?"
"I sure do," said Hill. "I asked for this meeting. I want to tell you what happened. I swear to tell the truth."
The conference room door opened, and Len Parisi entered. The DA was a big man, tall, over 300 pounds, and had coarse red hair. He was known for his sharp legal mind, his tenacity, and his impressive record of wins. Parisi was taking special interest in this case, among hundreds under his purview, because the People v. Hill would be a media supermagnet, a sex scandal with radical social implications. Before his office asked for an indictment, Parisi wanted to get his own sense of Brianna Hill. He shook hands with Hill and Giftos and sat down heavily in the chair next to Yuki. He clicked a ballpoint pen a few times with his large thumb and tapped the point on a pad of paper in front of him. He looked across the table, smiled, and said,
"Ms. Hill, this is your meeting. As long as you tell the truth, nothing you say can be used against you."
"I'm aware," said Hill.
Yuki kept a poker face, but she was excited to be facing off against James Giftos on such an important case. This was why she loved her job with the DA. Chapter 6. Brianna Hill clasped her hands in front of her and said,
"This is a pretty grim story, but it needs to be told. Where should I start, James? With the so-called incident, or with what led up to it?"
Her attorney said,
"Give us the background first."
"Okay. Mr. Parisi, Ms. Castellano, the first thing you should know is that Mark had been working for me for about 6 months when he let me know he was interested in me. He sent flowers to my apartment on my birthday, and I wouldn't say he was stalking me, but he was just there when I'd leave the office, go over to Starbucks, like that. He bought me coffee, and the next time I bought coffee for him. Takeout. Then he asked me out. I said no. I wasn't thinking of him that way. If the thought even crossed my mind, I shut it down. It was possible that going out with Mark could screw up the chain of command and make people in the creative department uncomfortable."
Yuki said,
"What changed your mind?"
Said Hill,
"I'm getting to it. Coming right up. Anyway, I fended Mark off, but he persisted, and I realized that I was starting to like him. He was funny, very charming, and by the way, a good producer. So I said okay to lunch. It's just lunch, right?
Yuki noted a couple of things as Brianna spoke. One, she was an accomplished presenter. Two, according to Hill, Christopher had made the advances. That meant nothing in terms of her guilt or innocence, but it was good for the defense version of the assault. I liked Mark, Hill said, but this was just a flirtation until... Cue the dramatic music. The Kronos beer shoot in Phoenix 4 months ago. It was a great shoot, big budget, terrific director, and all of us, the production company and the agency people, were staying in a nice hotel. So we wrapped the shoot and went for dinner and drinks at the hotel bar and grill at the end of the last day. I was very happy, Hill said. Everyone was. It was a celebration, and Mark and I closed the bar. It was like we were alone on a desert island. He invited me back to his room. I went. Hill clamped her mouth shut. She swallowed hard. She seemed to be remembering what had transpired that night. It looked to Yuki that she was unhappy with the memory. Giftos said,
Go on, Brianna. What happened when you came back to town and re-entered the atmosphere of everyday life?
Hill sighed, then seemed to steel herself for the sordid tale of her new relationship with Mark Christopher. Chapter 7. Brianna Hill had been talking for half an hour, and her confident demeanor was starting to sag. She sounded resigned when she said, Mark and I started dating. I wasn't in love with him, but I wasn't seeing anyone else. Eventually, though, I started losing interest, and Mark was getting the message. He got needy and borderline aggressive. One night, he stopped by my office at the end of the day, and when he said, Let's grab a bite, I said, Okay. I thought we'd have a discussion about how the relationship wasn't working out and probably agree to call it off. But that's not what happened. We went to our usual place, a restaurant called Panacea, a short walk from Mark's apartment. I started with a pre-dinner drink. Actually, I was drinking before, during, and after dinner. I think Mark was talking about politics, but I wasn't really listening. I was trying to decide whether to break up with him that night or to give it more time, weighing the pros and cons. After dinner, we moved to the restaurant bar. That's when Mark pitched his big idea.
It was his big idea? Len said.
Yeah. He knew I carried a gun, and he said that it really turned him on. He said that he wanted me... to pretend to rape him. He said I should hold the gun on him and order him to tie himself to the bed and follow my directions, or I would kill him. Something like that. It was ridiculous, but I'd never played out a fantasy like that. He kept saying it would be fun with this big grin on his face. And he said it would be good for our relationship. He wanted me to gut feel how much I wanted him. I think that's how he put it. We went to his apartment. That's where we always went, Hill said. I unloaded my gun, put the shells in my bag, then I followed his script and tried to get into the role. It was kind of fun, but also kind of weird, what I remember of it. After the sex was over, I fell asleep. We both did. Passed out is more like it. I woke up at about 5 and untied his hands. He was still sleeping, so I went home. I didn't like how I felt, and I didn't like him either. I knew that we'd crossed a line. There was no way back. I avoided him at work, Hill continued, but he called and left messages saying he wanted to get together. I told him no. Sorry, Mark, but it's over. He didn't like that, but I thought he'd move on. Instead, he came to my office after work a couple of days later and shut the door. That's when he told me that he'd recorded our sex play. Recorded it. And that he wanted $250,000 or he was going to post the video online. Yuki asked,
You took this to be a serious threat?
Hill's expression crumpled.
Yes,
she said.
It was believable that he had a hidden camera. He's a film producer. He knew that my grandma had died, and that she had left me a big pile of money. I told him to go to hell, but I was scared. I was also in shock. I'm still in shock.
Yuki found Brianna utterly credible. Was she a world-class actress? Or was her version of the story true? One of them was lying. Giftos put his hand on Brianna's shoulder and told her to take a minute. After she'd collected herself, but still noticeably distressed, she said,
I remembered some of what we did in his bedroom, but very little of what was said. Still, I'm positive that everything I did and said was entirely scripted by Mark. I never ever thought of rape as a turn-on. And I surely never knew that he was recording this game.
Hill went on.
I've always known the only way to defeat a bully is to stand up to him. Mark Christopher is a bully. He's also insecure and vengeful, and that's being kind. I did not rape him. It was all his idea. He set me up. And that's the whole truth.
Chapter 8. Yuki had questions. Lots of them. Sitting across the conference table from Brianna Hill and her attorney, Len and Yuki fired away. Yuki stuck to the workplace relationship between Hill and Christopher. Did management at the ad shop prohibit relationships at the agency? Was Ms. Hill in a position to influence Mr. Christopher's promotions and raises? Why was his performance review poor after the incident in Mr. Christopher's apartment? Hill told them that there was no explicit rule prohibiting relationships within the agency. Yes, she could influence his raises, but she explained that after the so-called rape incident, Mark was defiant and threatening. He walked away from an assignment, leaving the team to scramble and endangering an account. Naturally, his crummy attitude and insubordination were reflected in the one performance review I conducted with him. Len's questions were about the gun and the sex. Was her gun registered? Did she have a concealed carry permit? Where exactly did she keep the gun? Did she ever have it out during sex with Christopher or anyone else prior to the event they were discussing? Would she describe her sexual preferences as non-traditional or kinky? Hill asserted that she lived alone, traveled often, had obtained a concealed carry permit, and had carried a gun for most of her adult life. Her gun was registered, and she kept it in her handbag at all times for protection. She added, I don't know what you would call kinky, Mr. Parisi, but until this encounter with Mark Christopher, I'd never experimented with aggressive sexual role-playing. Len said,
And you claim you don't know what you said or did during this sex act?
I remember enough, she said. I remember the pitch he threw me in the bar, but not much of what I said or what he said during the act itself. It was role-playing. We were having sex. I'd had a lot to drink. I wasn't trying to remember what we said. Wouldn't that have been crazy? When I think about it, I see flash images, as if the bed was under a strobe light. As soon as it was over, I wanted to forget it had happened. I have some questions for you, Mr. Parisi. Why didn't Mark grab my gun? Run for the hills? Call the cops? Did you ask him?
Parisi said mildly,
If you know, had Mark been drinking too?
Sure. I don't remember what or how much.
Parisi asked,
Before or during the sex, did Mark tell you to stop? Did he say no to you at any point?
He may have, said Hill, but that was the point of the script he laid out for me. He was supposed to be the victim, and I was supposed to take him by force. That was his game.
Yuki said,
Ms. Hill, can you prove that Mr. Christopher set up this game?
How? We had a conversation in a bar.
I have the recording Mr. Christopher made of your sexual encounter, said Yuki. We'll have a copy sent to Mr. Giftos' office this week. It's video with sound, Ms. Hill. You can see and hear it all.
After Brianna Hill and James Giftos left, Yuki went to Len's office. They sat at right angles to each other in his sitting area, surrounded by bookshelves in view of the clock with a red bulldog face on the wall behind his desk.
What did you think of the defense?
Yuki asked.
Hill is credible, said Len, and a very accomplished presenter. But her defense of the rape, saying that Mark gave her the script and she performed to his direction, that's her word against his. We don't have the script discussion recorded. The video only shows and tells what happened in the bedroom, and even then, while the act was in progress.
Yuki asked,
does the fact that they'd slept together before the rape hurt his case?
Parisi said,
not legally, but it could make a juror wonder what the hell he was complaining about. Unless you can turn up more evidence, we're pinning everything on the video. He said no, and she kept the gun on him. He says it was loaded, she says it was not. He said, she said. But she asks good questions,
Parisi continued.
Why didn't he call the cops when he woke up? Why did he wait 2 weeks to do that? That's going to come up. And I don't like this story that he tried to blackmail her. Did that ring true to you?
Yuki said, this is the first I've heard of extortion. I'll ask him.
Unless he puts that in writing, it's more of his word against hers.
Yuki nodded in agreement.
They have colleagues in common. I interviewed 3 people at the ad shop. I'll review their notes again.
Yuki went back to her office and made notes to file on the meeting with Brianna Hill. Hill had sounded truthful, but Yuki had seen the video. Mark Christopher said no, and Brianna Hill didn't stop. And that was what mattered in the eyes of the law. Chapter 9. At 7:45 on a hazy Friday morning, I parked my Explorer in the all-day parking lot on Bryant Street across from the Hall of Justice, where I work in homicide. I crossed the street between breaks in the traffic and jogged up the steps to the main entrance of the gray granite building that housed not only the southern station of the SFPD, but also the DA, the municipal courts, a jail, and the motorcycle squad. I was reaching for the handle of the heavy steel and glass front door to the hall when I heard someone call out,
Sergeant? Sergeant Lindsay Boxer.
I turned to see a middle-aged woman with graying blonde hair, who was wearing a dirty fleece hoodie and baggy jeans, hurrying up the steps toward me. I wasn't surprised to be recognized. My last case had been high profile. A murdering psycho had blown up a museum, killing and injuring dozens of people, including my husband. For weeks after the bombing and all during the bomber's trial, my picture had been on the front page of the San Francisco papers and on the local TV news. Months later, memories of that unspeakable crime still rippled through the public consciousness. From the woman's dress, she looked to me like she was living on the street. I had change from a 10 in my jacket pocket, and I pulled out some bills, but she waved them away.
I don't need any money. Thank you, though. What I need is your help, Sergeant. I want to report a murder.
I looked at her. The assertion sounded like the opening to an old episode of Murder, She Wrote, but I had to take it seriously. The woman was distressed, and I'm a cop. We were blocking the entrance to the hall. Attorneys and clerks and other cops were trying to get past me, some rudely, some urgently. I stepped aside.
What's your name?
I asked.
Millie Cushing. I pay my taxes.
I let that one go. If she lived in San Francisco, she had a right to ask me for help.
This murder, I said. What can you tell me about that?
Well, I didn't see the murder happen, and I didn't see the victim's body, but I knew him. Jimmy Dolan wasn't the first one to get shot dead on the street, and he's not going to be the last, either.
Was Millie Cushing of sound mind? I couldn't tell. I said, you know what? The morning shift is just starting, and our squad room is going to be noisy. Let's go someplace where we can talk. Chapter 10. I led Millie to Cafe Roma, a small chain coffee shop on Bryant, up the very long block and across the street from the hall. We found a small booth near the plate glass window and the waitress took our orders. Coffee for Millie,
tea and dry toast for me. I said, Millie, order whatever you want. Millie took the cue and ordered eggs, toast, potatoes, sausage, and bacon. She laughed, saying,
I guess that will hold me for the weekend.
When the waitress left the table, I asked Millie to tell me everything she knew about the murder that had brought her to the hall that morning looking for me. She leaned across the small table and began her story.
The murder happened outside Walton Square, she said.
I knew the park well. It was in the financial district, not far from Southern Station's beat. Millie said,
It happened very early on Monday morning. This nice man named Jimmy Dolan was shot on the sidewalk on Front Street. Right here, she said, tapping the center of her chest. Two and done.
How did you learn about this? I asked.
You wouldn't think so, but we're a tightly knit community. Jimmy was shot at 4:15 or so in the morning, and 3 hours later it was common knowledge on the street. And that's by word of mouth and very few cell phones, you know.
Community?
Homeless, she said. For some, it's temporary. For others, it's a permanent way of life. The point is, we know one another. We keep tabs. We exchange news at the shelters and places we go on the street.
Breakfast came and Millie tucked in. I excused myself while she was occupied to call my partner, Rich Conklin, to tell him that I was running late, but would be in soon. I went back to my seat and sugared my tea. Millie was well into her scrambled eggs. I said, Millie, the police were called?
What I heard is they came, but they never asked around or did anything but wait until the meat wagon arrived. Jimmy deserves more than to be shoveled up and stuffed into a box. He deserves justice. The man was a poet, a good one. And before the voices got to him, he was a college professor. To the cops, he's trash.
I murmured, sorry to hear this, and asked Millie to go on.
Like I said, shootings are happening all over. Jimmy was one of, I don't know how many of us who have been killed, and I tell you, Sergeant, being with you is the safest I've felt in a year.
A year? I resisted an impulse to reach across the table and take her hands. If she was delusional, I was buying right in. When the table was cleared, Millie said thanks to a coffee refill and picked up where she'd left off. It felt like she'd been waiting a long time for someone to listen to her, to help her.
It's obscene, Millie said. I can't be exact, but I can count 3 other killings, Sergeant Boxer, and none of them have been properly investigated. I saw your picture in the paper after the bombing, and I felt something for you. Like a connection.
As we stood to go, I told Millie I would follow up, giving her my card. Do you have a phone?
Sometimes I forget to charge it, she said.
But she pulled an old flip phone from her pocket and showed me. I forced some small bills on her, then told her I'd look into the case of Jimmy Dolan. I paid the tab and headed back to the hall. I thought about Millie as I walked. She was well-spoken, seemed educated and sane. Her story and Millie herself were believable. I wondered how she'd ended up on the street. As I climbed the Hall of Justice steps, I felt lightheaded. I had lied to Millie when I said I'd had breakfast. I'd gulped coffee and kissed my family goodbye, expecting to have another cup of coffee at my desk. Honestly, I hadn't felt hungry, which wasn't normal for me. I took the elevator to the 4th floor and entered the homicide squad room. After saying hey to Conklin, I went to the break room and snagged the last donut in the box. Someone had hacked off a piece of it. In my humble opinion, that was an irrelevant detail. It was chocolate-glazed chocolate, the very best kind. I bit into it. It was good. Chapter 11. The homicide squad room is a square gray bullpen with our receptionist just inside the door, our lieutenant's glassed-in office in the back corner with a window onto the freeway. In between, on both sides of the narrow center aisle, are a handful of desks used by the other homicide inspectors. There has been some talk that we'll be moving to newer quarters within the decade, and I hope it's more than gossip. Conklin and I have facing desks at the front of the room, equidistant from the entrance and the break room. I shucked off my jacket, threw it over the back of my chair, and dropped into the seat. Conklin said,
"You have chocolate right here."
He pointed to the right side of his mouth. I sighed, grabbed a tissue, and under his direction, rubbed at the spot. "Okay now?" I asked him. Conklin and I have known each other for years. He was a beat cop who told me he'd like to be in homicide. When positions in our department reshuffled, my former partner, Warren Jacoby, got a promotion, and Rich Conklin and I became a team. Known around the hall as Inspector Hottie, Conklin is in his mid-30s, brown-eyed, brown-haired, good-looking and good-doing, altogether just about the perfect American boy next door. We love each other like siblings without the rivalry, complement each other's strengths, and shore up the other's weaknesses. In confrontational situations, interrogations, for instance, I'm the one throwing fastballs and Richie is the good cop, telling me to take it easy. Wink, wink. He's especially good with women. They trust him on sight. Conklin gave me a thumbs up after assessing the chocolate. He said,
"You going to tell me about your mystery breakfast?"
Phones were ringing. The overhead TV was on low but not mute, and people were talking over the ambient noise. I said, "A homeless woman named Millie Cushing tagged me as I was coming through the door. She wanted to tell me that a series of homeless people have been shot to death over the last year or so, and that the cops haven't done anything about it."
"First I've heard of this," Rich said.
"The shootings have been happening in Central Station's beat, that's why."
"Ah, jeez,"
my partner said.
"This isn't good."
While the citywide homicide detail is located here at Southern Station, a vestigial homicide detail operates out of Central Station, the result of a redistricting before my time. Officially called a station investigative team, Central Homicide sweeps up homicides that are called into their district during the graveyard shift. That's fine with me. God knows we have enough crimes to solve right here in our own house. I told my partner what Cushing had told me, that a man named Jimmy Dolan had been shot sometime in the wee hours down on Front Street. Since I hadn't heard about any killings of street people on our beat, and I would have, it could only mean that all of these shootings had happened in Central. I promised Millie I'd look into what she says is an ongoing pattern of homeless shootings, no arrests, I concluded. Rich was already tapping on his keyboard, searching for a report of a homicide outside Sidney G. Walton Square.
"Got it," he said.
"Victim.
James Dolan, white male, 50, shot twice in the chest at approximately 4 a.m. No witnesses to the shooting. Investigation ongoing. Body at Metro Hospital morgue."
I said, "That's the guy. Who was assigned to the case?"
"Sergeant Garth Stevens and Inspector Evan Moran. I don't know them. You?"
"I know of Stevens," I said. "He's been on the job for 25 years.
"Stevens and Moran work graveyard shift," Conklin said.
I called Sergeant Stevens before Conklin and I clocked out for the day and was put through to his desk at Central. He knew my name, said he'd even worked with my father, Marty Boxer, back in the day. My father was a bad news cop and a worse husband and dad, but I let the comment slide with a, "No kidding." I said, "Sergeant, you're investigating that shooting at Walton Square?"
"Yeah. Vagrant took a couple of rounds to the chest, killed instantly. Why do you want to know?"
"A citizen got hold of me and said there may have been several incidents like this one. Does that sound right?"
"You have a suspect in this shooting?"
he asked, answering my question with one of his own. "No."
"Then don't worry about this, Sergeant. Moran and I are on it. Nice chatting with you."
And then he hung up. I put the receiver back in the cradle and said to Conklin, "Stevens blew me off."
"Typical,"
said Conklin.
"Old timer. Get off of my cloud."
I had a bad feeling about it. It wasn't just that the old timer had been rude. Maybe he had a reason for blowing me off. Maybe there was something he didn't want me to know. Chapter 12. Yuki was hunched over her computer rereading transcripts of her interviews with some of Mark Christopher's associates from the ad shop. Parisi had warned her that their case pretty much rested on the video, and she agreed. The recording was powerful. Yuki thought that if it was true the DA could get a grand jury indictment with a ham sandwich, then Mark Christopher's rape video was a 5-star, 7-course meal with a vintage wine. No doubt she could get a grand jury indictment. If they went to trial, the rape video had to go into evidence and had to be shown to the jury. Giftos would try to get the video excluded. That way, if he put Hill on the stand, the jury would hear both versions of the sex act. Only one juror had to agree that the rape was staged, and Brianna Hill would be found not guilty. Yuki had to find more evidence to shore up her case if the video was thrown out. But how? No one else had been in the bedroom with Hill and Christopher. The cops had photographed fading bruise marks on Mark's wrists and ankles, but apparently Mark hadn't told anyone that he had been raped until 2 weeks after the fact. Now she wondered if anyone else had had a sexual encounter with Brianna Hill that could be called rape. As she reread the interview transcripts, she was looking for something that she might have missed, a comment that she should have probed, a tell that she had let slide. She called up the transcript of senior art director Lyle Bevins. He was 42, had worn red-rimmed glasses and an untucked plaid shirt over his jeans, had long hair, and had smelled like weed. He had seemed to enjoy the meeting with the ADA and been willing to spend as much time as she would allow. She had interviewed him because he had frequent and recent experience working with both Christopher and Hill. Yuki highlighted the relevant parts of the transcript, including the part where Bevins told her that Brianna Hill was hot and demanding. "She's a sex bomb." Yuki: "Mr. Bevins, did Ms. Hill use inappropriate sexual advances to manage or manipulate her staff?" Bevins: "I would say that she's all woman with a masculine determination to get her done. You looked at her, you thought about sex, and she carried a gun. That was sexy too." Yuki: "You say that you heard about Mark Christopher's accusation that she'd raped him. What was your reaction to that?" Bevins: "You're asking me if I think she could have done it? Yeah, if I had to make a wager. I'd bet she made him her bitch." Yuki: "Did you ever see her make inappropriate demands on Mark Christopher?" Bevins: "They were dating. You know that, right? So did she slap his butt once?" "Yeah, sure. I saw that." Yuki opened the next transcript, the interview with Bill Keeley, CEO of the ad shop and Brianna Hill's superior. She remembered that Keeley's wardrobe was gray, his haircut was Republican, and his work history was account management, not creative. Brianna Hill had a dotted line reporting relationship to him. He had made the final decision in hiring her, and recently he had put her on waivers. Keeley: "I didn't want to suspend her, but this situation is a distraction, and our clients don't want any association with her." Yuki: "How would you describe her worth to the firm?" Keeley: "A+. Hardworking, corporate values, delivered a great product. I don't know her personally." "So, is that all?" Yuki: "Almost. Were there any complaints about her being sexually provocative or aggressive with agency staff?" Keeley: "I heard some hallway gossip that I put down to sexism. She was a good-looking woman in a power position. But no complaints came to me officially." Yuki opened the transcript of her interview with Maria Cortez, the production department assistant. Cortez had worn tight jeans, a black shirt, and great lace-up boots, and had tattoos on her hands and neck. If Keeley would be the last to know if Hill was guilty of sexual harassment, Cortez would be the first. She reported directly to Hill and was the go-to person for the whole production staff. Cortez: "Brianna is tough. She has to be. She's not a rapist, that I can tell you. Men like her, she likes them. They flirt with her, too. But she's honest and has a good heart. Yuki, you like her? Cortez, I do. And I like Mark, too. Yuki, what do you think of the rape accusation against Ms. Hill? Cortez, I'd like to say it was all a misunderstanding. Yuki, thanks, Ms. Cortez. I appreciate your time. Parisi called Yuki on her private line.
I thought you'd still be there.
I'm reviewing my notes now, she said. I have another interview in 5 minutes that could be a decider. I'll have a point of view in the morning.
I'll be standing by, said the DA.
Chapter 13. Paul Yates was about 30, lanky with thinning hair and a thick beard, conveying an overall pleasant good guy appearance. He shook her hand.
I'm Polly.
She offered coffee and Yates asked for orange soda.
Coffee or water, that's what I've got, she said with a laugh. Your choice.
He said,
water would be great.
Hang on a sec, she said.
She went out to the kitchen, got a glass bottle of water out of the fridge, and returned with it to her office.
Premium H2O, she said, passing the bottle to Yates. Comes from the heart of a glacier, I think. Or else the Hetch Hetchy Reservoir. I don't really know, she said with a grin.
He grinned back and thanked her, and Yuki showed Yates the tape recorder.
I'll be taping. Any problem?
None that I can think of.
Yuki switched on the small recorder. Yates got comfortable in the chair across the desk from her, and then reached over the desk and turned one of the framed photos toward him.
Nice-looking guy, said Yates. Your husband?
Yuki took the photo out of his hand, put it back under her desk lamp, and said,
Let's talk about you.
If we must, he said.
Paul Yates had come to San Francisco from Spokane 5 years before. He currently had a girlfriend, Amy, and they shared a rescue dog, Bosco. Yates was a copywriter at the ad shop and had won an award for last year's Skipperoo dog food campaign. He knew Mark, but they didn't hang out together. Yuki said,
Polly, I need to ask you about Brianna Hill.
Okay, shoot.
Did Mark tell you that she had raped him?
No. I only heard about it when the police started interviewing people at the agency.
And what did you think when you heard there had been a sexual assault?
I try to ignore gossip and office politics. I've never known of anything good to come out of either.
Good call, Yuki said with a smile. Why do you think Mark thought I should speak with you?
Probably because I went out with Brianna. Before Amy. Before Mark, too.
Yuki asked,
Can you tell me about dating Brianna?
There's not much to tell, said Yates. I only went out with her once.
Did you have sex with her?
Christ! You want me to talk about that?
Please.
His expression tightened. He scowled. He said,
What happens if I tell you? You're going to ask me to testify, aren't you?
Paul, I can't say at this minute. Tell me what happened with you and Brianna Hill. You're in my office of your own volition. You're here to help me, but you aren't required to talk to me unless you committed a crime. Did you commit a crime?
Hell no, unless going out with a psycho is a crime.
You're saying that Brianna Hill is a psycho?
Paul Yates started shaking his head. Then,
Look, I don't know you, and this is embarrassing. I've never told anyone, and I don't want to ever tell anyone else. Not for any reason.
What happened, Polly? Did she threaten you?
It was terrifying.
I'm listening, Yuki said.
Yates reached over and pressed the stop button on the tape recorder. Yuki had to let him do it.
I'll tell you, but I am not going to testify, he said.
Okay. Okay, Polly. Just tell me.
Chapter 14. Yuki and Mark Christopher were taking the elevator to the fourth floor of the Civic Center courthouse, where she would be making her case to the grand jury within the next 20 minutes. The grand jury hearing was a trial run for the prosecutor. Yuki would present the case against Brianna Hill, her few witnesses would testify, and she would introduce her evidence. All of this would be done fairly quickly and with absolute secrecy. There would be no judge, no defendant, no other attorneys. Yuki would be entirely in charge of this presentation. Unlike with a petite jury, where the jurors had to be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt, here the grand jurors, or 12 of 19 of them, had only to find probable cause that Brianna Hill had raped Mark Christopher. If they found probable cause, they would indict, and the case would go forward to trial. The pressure was on Yuki, and on Mark. While Len Parisi had always shown confidence in Yuki, she had lost big cases. But for the most part, the losses were not because of error, lack of preparation, or poor skills. Once, a star witness for the prosecution had committed suicide. Another had choked on the stand and changed her testimony. And in one case, the defense had sprung a surprise witness who landed a crushing blow to the prosecution's case. Still, Yuki had notched several important wins. Although Parisi was skeptical about the Hill case, he had given her the green light to go to the grand jury. She was sure she was right to have fought for the case. The elevator lurched and stopped at the third floor. People got out, replaced by others squeezing in, and once the doors closed, the car continued its ascent. Standing beside Yuki, Mark Christopher was dressed in a navy blue suit and blue patterned tie. His hair was recently cut and he'd had a good shave. Yuki was wearing a blue suit, very much like the one Mark was wearing. No tie for her, but a strand of angel skin coral beads Brady had given her as a wedding gift. Unlike Yuki, Mark looked completely numb. Yuki suspected he'd popped a Xanax or two. If so, he'd made a mistake. Yuki needed him to bring the story of the sexual assault to life for the jury. He had to emote. He had to be able to describe the damaging effects of what he had been through. Yuki wanted to ask him again if he was feeling okay, but at this point, it no longer mattered. Unless Mark said in the next few minutes, "I've changed my mind, I want to drop the charges," the show would go on. She was ready. She could only hope that Mark would be ready too. The elevator doors slid open on the fourth floor. Yuki and Mark exited the elevator and walked down the hallway toward the grand jury room. Her three other witnesses were waiting in the corridor outside the courtroom door. Phyllis Chase, the arresting officer in the case, was in uniform. Paul Yates, the copywriter who had had one date with Brianna Hill, wore denim and a panicked look. And Frank Pilotti, the tech specialist who would run Mark's homemade rape video for the jury and testify to its authenticity, had the calm presence Yuki had hoped for in an expert witness. Yates and Christopher acknowledged each other with nods. Pilotti held open the heavy wooden door for Yuki, and she entered the grand jury room. It was a modern courtroom, wood paneling and white-painted plaster under a drop ceiling lit with embedded fluorescent fixtures. The judge's bench at one end of the room would not be in use. Instead, a massive wooden table had been set up facing the jurors. Yuki took her place behind the table, and her four witnesses sat alongside her. The 19 jurors had been impaneled for almost a month, and had heard 100 cases in that time. And still, Yuki was pretty sure they hadn't ever heard a case like this one. Yuki felt almost calm. She was prepared. In just a little while, she would know if she would be putting Brianna Hill on trial for sexual assault in the first degree. Chapter 15. Yuki made her succinct opening remarks to the jurors, each word carefully chosen.
It may be hard to imagine a woman forcing a strong young man into an act of sexual intercourse against his will. Now imagine that this woman is his boss, that she had a gun in her hand, and that she threatened to blow him away if he didn't perform. In a few minutes, Mark Christopher, the victim, will tell you exactly what happened to him. But first, I want you to hear from Inspector Chase of Sex Crimes, who investigated this case.
Yuki called Inspector Phyllis Chase. The foreperson